and welcome to this episode of The Broadcast, the latest in our little series we're doing, looking at what the trustees should be thinking about into the year 2025. And this time we're going to be looking at investment consulting, investment advice. And I'm joined by Mark Devereaux, who's our head of investment consulting, and Ros Scott Douglas, who is an investment director here at Broadstone. So hi, guys. Welcome along.
Hi.
Okay. So the first bit I wanted to talk about, I suppose, is a bit more backward looking than forward looking. I know I just said it would be into what trustees were looking at into the future. But the last few years, we've seen general funding improvements and a changing position for trustees. Investment strategies on the back of that, you know, as we refer back to the Liz Truss quasi Kwarteng budget too often these days. I think it's over 2 years ago now, but it still hangs in our minds. But as buy-in and buy-out become realistic targets, how has that impacted investment strategies for schemes that have found themselves in a better position than they expected? And I think I'm going to pick on Ros for that one. So Ros, what are you seeing in strategies reacting to that?
Thanks, Dave. Yeah, the last few years have seen quite a sea change for pension schemes. So long-dated bond yields have risen by about 3.5% since 2022, and by about 4.5% since their sort of lows around 2020. That means that the value of a typical pension scheme's liabilities might be sort of half what they were in 2020. So it's a very significant change in the value of the liabilities. So schemes have seen their funding levels rise significantly. And for many of our clients, that's meant an accelerated path towards buy-in or buy-out. Within Broadstone alone, our buyout advisory team helped our clients to complete, I think it was 15 deals last year, and as at February, 4 deals within 2025 so far alone. So there's an awful lot of schemes that are moving that way, and moving that way a lot faster than they thought they would. On the other hand, because so many schemes have seen significant improvements, there's now a queue of schemes looking to move to a buy-in or buy-out, and only a certain amount of capacity among the insurers. So what we're advising clients is it's important to be as prepared as possible going into that process in order to get yourself towards the front of the queue. That's got lots of aspects to it, but from an investment strategy perspective, when we're advising clients, that typically means hedging 100% of your liability value on a long-term prudent basis, so some sort of buyout proxy. So that means investing your assets so that they match movements in how your liabilities change as closely as possible when interest rates and inflation expectations change. On the growth side, it means really holding little or no growth assets like equities, because they're just too volatile at that stage and you don't need the growth. And then potentially holding some more liquid and high quality corporate bonds or other types of lending, because that matches the sort of investments that an insurer holds. The other thing that we look at with schemes that are approaching that sort of level of funding is to make sure that their assets are liquid enough that they can also be easily sold or transferred to the insurer. So that's really what we've been seeing for schemes that have sort of become better funded, and often it has been sort of a very dramatic change, and we're trying to get them to move quickly to sort of take advantage of that improved funding position.
And I suppose on the back of that, you know, you were talking about the change in liability values and sort of the emergence of surpluses. So Mark, I'm going to bring you in really, because that's triggered the government to really push the rhetoric and potentially policy around what run-on could look like. I'd invite you to give a little bit more on what run-on means and what that looks like, and how that can be advantageous to members and sponsors, and how that then feeds into changing strategies and this government rhetoric of maybe turning the risk back on a bit for some schemes, or risk on in a different way. You know, Ros was just talking about equities not being perhaps the right place to be as you approach buyout, but other asset classes they seem to be keen on. This is one of those long questions about 20 different parts. But also, you kind of add to that sort of tension with the regulator's long-held view. Again, Ros was touching on this, of sort of locking down volatility by having, gilt-like assets to sort of stop that volatility. So this sort of has led us into this new world. So how's that new world been playing out, Mark?
Yeah, there's quite a lot in that.
Yeah, sorry.
Do my best to tackle that at a high level, because we could do, I suppose, a whole session in itself on the pros and cons of running on. But if we, and there's lots of details to consider as part of that decision as to whether you go to the insurance buyout market, or do you run on with the expectation you're going to buy out at some point in the near future, or do you just make the decision that, you know, we're going to run on indefinitely until something changes. So if we put aside the sort of the detailed considerations, and we assume that a scheme has decided that it wants to continue running on, then I think from an investment perspective, it's going to be very scheme specific in terms of what those considerations are and what that investment strategy looks like. So crucially, it's going to depend on the views of the sponsor and the trustee as to what that strategy looks like, and it will, I'm sure, depend on and be a function of the funding position, the covenant support that's there, because whilst you're running on, you might be in a low risk position, but it probably isn't a zero risk position. So you need to be cognizant of that. And it will critically depend, I think, on what you intend to use any surplus for. So it's the use case for the surplus. And that could involve any number of things, like using surplus to fund benefit enhancements for your existing members, using surplus to fund defined contributions, DC contributions into some other arrangement, or using surplus to effectively give back to the employer. And we obviously are awaiting some important rules in terms of how surplus extraction might look like, but ultimately it could be one of those or a combination of those things. So understanding what you're actually intending to use the surplus for, I think, is really important. And once we know those rules, obviously, that will be an important unknown at this time. And that's going to influence, I think, your time horizon, your risk reward appetite, your profile of investments that you're going to look to hold, and things like the liquidity of those assets. And I think, just going back to one of your points on how does this tie in with the regulator, I find it just quite useful to look at the assets very simply as a pool of assets which is backing your liabilities, and then there's a sort of a pool of assets which represents your surplus assets. And if you think about the assets that are sort of you designated to cover your liabilities, then I would expect those assets are pretty low risk in nature, the sorts of assets that Ros has just spoken about, have a high degree of liability hedging and or cash flow matching. You'll have a pretty high level of liquidity within those assets, and you'll be pretty resilient to withstand sort of adverse market shocks that might impact your funding position. And then if you look at the surplus assets, well, I think there's just a whole lot more flexibility in terms of how you might go about thinking about investing the surplus assets. And if you think about it in those two simple pools, I think you are able to sort of be funding consistent, and you know, you can demonstrate to the regulator that your liabilities are well covered in the way that the funding code is sort of intending trustees to do. But then the surplus, there's effectively scope to, I suppose, exercise a greater degree of flexibility and freedom. And that can include all sorts of things like higher risk assets, illiquid assets, investments which are intended to be investments for purpose, or productive finance is another phrase we've heard a lot. All of those considerations, I think, will feed in. And it's being resilient. It's being making sure that you've got contingency plans in case things go wrong, that you're able to change course if something happens in the future, and the decision to run on changes. So it's thinking through all those things. So I think in summary, what I'd say is we've got those important rules around surplus extraction, which will make the whole picture a bit clearer. But many schemes are thinking already and will be thinking about that run-on scenario. So I think having that extra layer of detail will be important. But I think it's perfectly possible to operate a run-on situation with a surplus and be consistent with the sort of the low risk intentions of the regulator's funding code.
So you touched on the funding code. I do want to ask a very short question to Ross. I'm going to promise myself as you were talking, I was going to ask a short question. But I just on run-on, you know, we talk about it, and I know we don't get too much in the weeds of it, but I'm trying to think, what sort of time horizon are you thinking with run-on? When you're advising a client who's interested in run-on, are you thinking this is run-on in perpetuity? We're going to keep running on as if the scheme, like the old days, that the scheme was never going to buy out. We're going to keep going until the last spouse, you know, the last spouse or the last pensioner passes away type thing. Or are you thinking, what sort of time horizons should our trustees thinking of when they're thinking about running on?
I think it's a very scheme specific question, Dave. It's probably going to be a function of current size, your ability to retain a self-sufficient position, that low risk sort of basis that you want, because things can change, you know. No strategy is zero risk unless you go to an insurer and just discharge the liabilities in whole. So the risk profile can change, the covenant support can change, the corporate picture could change, you know, the ownership structure could change, the management team could change, and the whole direction of travel could therefore change course down the line. So never say never, but I suspect that the decision to run on indefinitely ultimately might change at some point. It might be a very long way off, but I think we always need to be cognizant of the fact that things can and will change, and hence my point about contingency planning. You know, be prepared to change course as and when you need to.
Okay, thank you. Right, Ros, as promised, there's a short question for you, and Mark touched on it as well. So the funding code from the pensions regulator came into force last year. What are the key investment implications that trustees should be aware of?
Yeah, we've got quite a number of clients with valuation dates just passed or coming up soon. So we're working through this with them now. So it's really topical. And while we've seen the code in draft for some time, it's the first time we're all doing this for real. So there are lots of implications under the new code, but from an investment perspective, well, actually an investment and funding perspective, trustees need to set out a plan for achieving full funding on a low dependency objective and adopting a low dependency investment allocation. So I suppose those investment implications and the funding implications are very intertwined. But looking specifically at that low dependency investment allocation, the requirements in the code are actually almost all principles based. So it's kind of common sense. I guess what it's introducing here is it really means that trustees who might previously only have been thinking about planning towards full funding on technical provisions are being required to look beyond that. But the principles of what that does look like are common sense in terms of what you would look like for a low risk strategy. So it's all really around that point of low dependency. It has to be a strategy where you're expected to be able to continue without having to go back to your sponsor. So firstly, it has to be highly resilient to market shocks. So I think that probably means some of the concepts that we've talked about already around targeting a high level of liability hedging and a lowish allocation to assets that are the most susceptible to market shocks, like equities. So probably similar to what we've discussed in that buyout and run-on sort of discussion. Secondly, being liquid enough, and it talks about being able to meet future cash flows, both planned and unplanned. There's quite a lot of detail in the code about this, actually. It talks an awful lot about how you're going to meet your liquidity needs and whether you can do that by redeeming assets, which have to be liquid enough to sell, or using income generated by the investments. But under both options, you have to think about what would happen if markets went against you, and trying to avoid sort of being a forced seller at the wrong time. The one specific point in the code where they really actually prescribe something is that they're expecting you to have hedging levels of at least 90% of your liabilities on a low dependency funding objective. So that's the one number that really jumps out. While the funding code is sort of principles based around what your low dependency investment allocation might look like, if you want to go through the fast track valuation process, then the pensions regulator specifies some particular stress tests and resilience levels that you would need to go through. We've been looking at that actually as a group, and it does give you a reasonable amount of flexibility. So it doesn't mean, when we looked at in sort of some example strategies, it does mean you can still hold a bit of growth assets. It's really just that if you're going to hold them, you have to have a plan for making back any deficit that might re-emerge if markets move against you. I think the real change here is for those schemes that maybe have just always been planning towards being fully funded on the next technical provisions basis, and everyone now has to have a long-term plan beyond that.
Okay. The next little topic I want us to cover, and I'm going to sort of divide you up into two, really. So one of you is going to tell me about growth assets and how the current market outlook is going to, how it affects decision making. One of you is going to tell me about low risk strategy. So Mark, I think you're going to tell me about growth assets. And in addition, and I was kind of hinting at it in the question before, when we were talking about run on and government policy and sort of how, if any illiquid investments can feature in sort of growth asset decision making.
Okay, thanks, Dave. And I think I'll tackle probably the most commonly used and obvious asset class in that sort of growth asset bucket, which is just listed equities first. Probably to start by making a few observations about what's, I suppose, current state of equity markets, because equities have performed relatively strongly over recent years. We've seen some stellar returns from global equities. And a lot of that really has been driven by outperformance in the US equity market. But if you sort of peer underneath the bonnet of global equities, there's been some quite stark differences in the returns from various different regions. And the global equity index is dominated by US equities. I forget off the what the composition looks like exactly, but we're talking about over two-thirds of global equity market is represented by the US. So it's a big driver. And if we look what's happened, sort of fast forward to 2025 calendar year to date, and what we're only just over 2 months in, that pattern has repeated. So we're seeing some big stark differences in returns from different regions. I think it closed yesterday, the US market was down around 5%, whereas the European market was actually doing much better and was up about 10%. But we have seen the headlines. Many regional equities, equity indices have done well. They've broken through their all-time highs. And I think that leads you to the obvious question, which is, can equity markets keep going? Are we going to see more strong sort of returns over the coming years? Or, are we at the point where equities look a bit expensive, perhaps, and we're sort of due a correction? And certainly there are some commentators who are picking up the fact that US stocks in particular look quite expensive. We've heard talk about the Magnificent Seven, and we've seen some very specific examples of individual stocks suffering pretty big falls over a very short period of time. You've also got the effects of Trump and domestic and global politics, tariff, trade wars, defense, huge shifts in defense spending, and all those sorts of things, which are playing a part in driving equity returns, and volatility has markedly increased. So, yeah, I think going back to my point about should we be concerned? Well, certainly it looks like there is a lot more concern, and we're seeing some high-profile long-term investors who are sort of taking a slightly risk-averse approach and investing more in cash as a protective measure. So if we think about equities as a strategic asset class for pension schemes, we tend to think about equities as being a long-term investment. And by long-term, we're talking about multi-year periods, so up to and over 10-year period of time. And over that sort of period, we're confident that equities should deliver a healthy excess return over an equivalent risk-free rate such as cash. As for what happens over the short term, the next 1 to 3 years, Who knows what equities are going to do over the course of the next year? There are so many factors at play. It really is very difficult. And who knows? But over the long term, we still think that equities are a strategically important asset class for clients and schemes that need to deliver that slightly higher expected return target. But it does make sense to periodically review and check that your equity exposure makes sense. So things like that, the regional composition, any concentrations, be aware of what they are, be comfortable with them. The ESG integration, is that appropriate? Does it fit with your beliefs and policies? And things like currency, we're seeing big shifts in currencies. Just making sure that any unhedged currency risk is set appropriately. So those are always good, sensible things to check in on from time to time. As far as your question on illiquids goes, I think that there are some sort of preconditions for investing in illiquid assets. The key ones being there has to be an appetite and there has to be an ability to accommodate illiquid assets. And by that, I mean, you have to be able to and prepared to lock up your money for a considerable period of time. Whether that's property type assets or private equity or private credit type markets, I think if you want genuine exposure to illiquid assets, you need to be able to have your assets locked up for a period. I think you also need, I think, to be confident that there is a compelling expected return to be had from investing in a liquid asset compared with a less illiquid or a liquid comparable, if there is one. So there is a return dimension I think you need to be comfortable with. And all of these things need to be journey plan consistent. If we go back to the discussion on run-on versus buyout, if buyout is the intended objective, then you need to have sufficient time to be able to invest properly in these assets and have them sort of deliver and then hopefully run off or be able to sell them at a point in the future of your choosing. Many schemes that are rushing to the buyout market are exiting illiquids before they've naturally run off, if that's the nature of the underlying investment. And there is always a way to sell illiquid assets in the secondary market. The question is, what's the discount? And because we're seeing lots of, lots of clients exiting these types of investments, the discounts have been quite steep. And if you're a buyer, that presents opportunity. So the secondary market is also potentially an attractive route into illiquids for those investors that can afford to take on more or increase their allocations.
Okay, great. So Roz, turning to you then, looking at the low risk portfolios, credit spreads are currently very low. Can you explain what that means for me, if anybody else? And also, how does that influence low-risk investment strategies?
Sure. Yeah, so a credit spread is the extra return above government bonds that you get by holding a corporate bond or providing some other kind of lending. So historically, for investment-grade corporate bonds, which are seen as the sort of safer kind of corporate bonds, the credit spreads that it offered above government bonds was about 1.5% a year. So you've got your yield or your return that you get from a government bond, and then there's about 1.5% above that from taking on the risk of lending to a company. Mm-hmm. It's currently less than 1% a year. So actually it's a sort of a little over half the long-term average in terms of the extra return. So that means that whilst government bond rates are high by historic comparisons, the extra return that you're getting from the corporate bonds above the government bonds is really low. So assuming that your risk of a loss on one of those bonds hasn't changed very much, it means you're now not being compensated so much for taking on the same level of risk by lending to these companies than you have been historically. When we talk to clients about this, my sort of general rule of thumb has been that what it means for each of their strategies really differs depending on whether you already hold corporate bonds or thinking about them as a new investment, and also what your objectives are for those corporate bonds. So corporate bonds compared to government bonds or equities are less liquid. So the costs of buying and selling them are higher. And so actually, a lot of clients, if you're already holding corporate bonds and are holding them for a specific purpose, like generating income, or maybe as a route to buy out to sort of hold something similar to what the insurers might be holding, then it might make sense to continue to hold them if they're still meeting that objective, even though you're sort of being compensated less for taking on that extra risk than you were before. For clients that don't hold any at the moment and are considering making a new investment or increasing the allocation, we're sometimes suggesting delaying that move into traditional corporate bonds, or spreading your allocation across a range of alternatives that might meet the same objectives as you had for the bonds. So we've been looking quite a lot at other types of credit or lending investments available that can still give you the same kind of level of sort of higher credit spreads that you used to be able to get on the corporate bonds. So you're getting a higher credit spread than corporate bonds are currently offering, but you're doing that for a similar amount of risk. Some of those assets might be ones that are a little bit less traditional or more difficult to understand. So it's important to sort of research them and understand what it is that you're holding. But I think by looking at those alternatives, you can find another way of meeting the same objectives that you would have for your corporate bond portfolio. So just sort of looking to diversify and looking elsewhere if you need that extra return now.
Well, that's a great segue, Ros. So talking about diversifying and looking elsewhere, our final topic, just to finish off this episode, I want to get your opinions, or if you're willing to give them. Mark, I'm going to pick on you first. Bitcoin, we know that a DB scheme in the UK has dipped its toe into some Bitcoin. I think they invested last year, shortly before the US election. What's your take on this?
Well, that was good timing, if it was just before the election, I suspect. Although things change quite rapidly in the world of Bitcoin and crypto assets, and yeah. I think in general, Dave, our view on this has not changed, and our view being that the characteristics really don't align terribly well to the sorts of characteristics we think are desirable for pension scheme investments. That said, there might be a small, very small number of situations where venturing into Bitcoin or current crypto type assets might be something that an employer and trustee group want to do, but I suspect they are likely to be pretty limited in terms of number in those sorts of situations where it is appropriate. And where that is the case, I think, you know, what we have seen is it's absolutely crucially important that the implementation is done thoughtfully and robustly and uses, you know, the proper expertise in terms of investment management and the safekeeping of those assets. But our view hasn't changed on Bitcoin and crypto, and it's not likely to be something that we're proactively talking to clients about.
Yeah, I mean, I've been very interested in this story, and it does keep popping up, and you know, and it sort of, you know, does it fit the fiduciary duty of a trustee? You know, you often get this with the reasonable person or the prudent person test, you know, when you're investing, and just whether it fits those characteristics, I think it's very difficult to justify using it when there's other tools out there. You know, what goal is it trying to achieve? A very quick win, bit of speculation, quick win, then really is that what pension schemes should be doing? Because what if the worst thing happens and it goes the opposite way and you don't get, you know, it just feels a bit too, without the intrinsic value, it feels risky. But I'm not an investment person, so I'll stop waffling. Okay, so that was all my questions. So I think I'll let all Mark, did you want to come back in on that?
No, but I think you summarised it really well, Dave. Thank you.
Okay, yeah. Fine. No, I wasn't sure if you were chapping the bit for one last go at the Bitcoin topic, but that's fine. Okay, so I'll leave it to me to say thank you to Roz and Mark for their time today, talking about what is on the trustee agenda as far as investments are concerned. We can do another episode on one of these soon, I think, looking at illiquids a bit more closely. So keep an eye out for that one. Otherwise, we'll see you on the next episode of the broadcast.